This is a production of Cornell University.
Okay, seeing as it is 5:30, I'd like to call this meeting to order. Today is February 15, 2021. Could we please proceed with the roll call of the voting members, please?
Yes. Okay. Mila Kantar. Jack Levin. Matthew Bulch.
I'm here.
Hannah Cole.
Present.
Stephanie Lopez.
Present.
Paul Vintage.
Here.
Martique Chatterjee. Maddie Keefe.
Here.
Tim Ludermoser. Jordan Dotzel.
Here.
Cody Duell.
Here.
Casey Laurent.
Here.
Chris O'Connor. Hannah Bittiger Curtis. Ruth Barankovich.
Here.
Meredith Welch.
Here.
Charlie Day.
Here.
Chris Anglin.
Here.
Natalie Gonzalez.
Here.
Shen Liu.
I'm here to substitute Chen to represent Johnson DCBC. I'm Sandra.
Okay, just a note though, but this is the voting call roll, because so it's Chen will be absent for the purpose, but you can speak on his behalf, but he can vote for himself.
Okay, so, got it.
Yeah.
Christine Owenewa.
Here.
Ryan Maloney.
Here. Here.
Amanda Cirillo. Alexandra Pressure. And Matthew Drescher. Okay. We have 15 out of 25.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So we have four of them.
Some people coming in later. So did any voting members come in later and didn't get their name called?
Yeah, Tim Ludermoser, LifeSci. I just joined. Sorry about that.
Also, okay. Mila Kantar just joined.
Okay, so that gives us 17 then. Okay. All right, in any case, we have quorum, so thank you very much. So let's move on to the next order of the day, which is the approval of the meeting minutes for February 1st, 2021. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Motion to approve the minutes.
Is there a second?
Second.
All right. Are there any objections to the approval of the minutes as they stand? All right, so seeing no objection, the minutes are approved, and we are now going to move on to our next order of business for today, which is presentations. Today we have Charlie Van Loan, the Dean of Faculty, who is here to present on the updates on anti-racism initiatives, as well as some other topics of interest to us. So, Charlie, thank you. You have the floor. Okay.
Is that visible to everybody?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks. I really appreciate the chance to come and talk to you. David did mention in his initial email that you're primarily interested in the anti-racism update, and I'm certainly will give you that. But there are two other things that are on the faculty's agenda that really would benefit from your feedback. So let me, now I can't, just a second here. Okay, so I'll do the first two quickly, and I'm very happy to answer questions when I'm all done, and certainly any follow-up get-togethers is also fine by me. So policy 1.2 is concerned with academic and research misconduct, and we're doing a major revision of that, and we're in the middle of that, and my guess is that we'll probably act on some final version within a month. This is important to graduate students. Quite often, graduate students are involved in cases, most often as witnesses, certainly sometimes as complainants and respondents. Just for your information, I get these. So this is just based on my recollections over the last 4.5 years. There are places on our website where you can upload comments. So certainly when we're all done here, if you have thoughts, we certainly want to hear from you. The way we're reorganizing this is it's not too fundamental, but we're going for much more detail and clarity. And I just want to mention something here at the start of the process when an allegation comes in the door. We're instituting what's called an assessment phase, sort of explicitly. We've always sort of had it, but now it's actually much more explicit, where the question is this actually a violation of policy 1.2 or not? So this is a big fork in the road. Perhaps it's an issue that should be handled by the Code of Academic Integrity. And my next slide will talk a little bit about what that fork in the road looks like. Or maybe it's tied up with other policies like 6.3 or 6.4. So before you launch this apparatus, a decision has to be made as to whether it's relevant. So just to shed a little bit of light on that, here's an example. So suppose, you know, we have several students in a professor's graded research seminar, okay? And let's say a student gets up and presents a write-up, okay, that includes something that is billed as a new idea. And then maybe a couple of days after that, another student who was at that seminar discovers that the text is related to this new idea was lifted from a journal publication. So something I won't go into here now is, you know, reporting, the reticence to report, ramifications of reporting. These are gigantic issues. But I just would like to assume that it has been reported and the kinds of questions that might come up, because I do want to at least get you thinking about differences between policy 1.2 and research misconduct versus the Code of Academic Integrity. So here are four increasingly more troublesome discoveries that might come up as a result of launching the 1.2 apparatus. Well, first of all, it could be just a complete oversight, right? We all know that when you do a rough draft of a research paper, maybe you just cut and paste into your rough draft, and then you, with the intention of going back and putting in the citations. And maybe PhD student A just forgot to do that, okay? So all our policies do take into consideration inadvertent oversights. But then slightly a little more concerning might be that, it was deliberate. The student just wanted to impress the professor, okay? And maybe it wasn't a graded presentation, but nevertheless, the student thought, well, you know, here's an occasion to sort of impress the professor, so I'll go ahead with this version. Slightly more complicated if the presentation was graded, okay? Would that change things? And finally, suppose the presentation was really coming out of the student's annual report that they just submitted to the NSF because they're an NSF fellowship. Well, a big watershed thing here is whether or not the allegation sort of went beyond the boundaries of the campus. So in the first three there, if it's all sort of within the context of a class, all right, certainly there's plagiarism overtones there in number two and three. That's the Code of Academic Integrity, okay? That's cheating in a class, okay? But once the episode, so to speak, transcends the boundary of the campus and gets out there, then suddenly that's incredibly more serious. The reputation of the university is at stake, and that's a 1.2 scene. That's research misconduct, okay? And one would be investigated under that setting. The point here is this. We really need graduate students to understand these sorts of decisions and to be familiar with this policy. And I'm hoping that to get some feedback from you on this. Okay. Anyway, so that's policy 1.2. It's a very big deal, and because this is our way of life, right? Research, and we have to make sure that we uphold the highest possible standard. Let me go on to a second project that we're working on, and it's very big and probably not of great interest to you except for one part of it. So when you come up for tenure, one feature of the dossier are letters from students, okay? Now, this particular project is going on all this semester. It's actually a two-year-old project. We're looking at every single possible process that is associated with tenure, from when you're hired to when the trustees approve it. And we're looking at everything, trying to make the procedures more transparent and clear, and in some cases proposing slight changes to how we do things. Anyway, one of the sections in this effort concerns letters from students, and we'd really like to hear from you on that. So here are five topics, and you can read about proposals for each of them, all right, that are concerned with the student letter portion of the dossier. For example, course evaluations, how do you organize that data, okay? How many students should you write to, and how do you pick their names, random or whatever? And of course, there are different answers to this, whether you're talking about U-grads in a big class, U-grads in a small class, or project supervisors in a master's setting, or PhD supervising in a graduate student setting. So they're all different parts to that. Also, you know, there's a very, advising and teaching are very intricately related, especially as you get up into the PhD area. How do you evaluate that? And then, mentoring is also in that picture. My only point here, and this is just a heads up, if you have thoughts about this, there's easy mechanism for you to tell us what your thoughts are. We set up a Qualtrics questionnaire where you can read about recommendations in each of these five areas. And if you have thoughts on them, by all means, upload them. Everything is anonymous, okay? Okay, so those are just two things that I'm piggybacking on my invitation here. They're very important. I know you have a lot to say about them, and the faculty would certainly like to hear your thoughts. Okay. Now, let's talk about the anti-racism initiative. Okay? And this started back in July with President Pollack had a directive that went to everybody on campus. She asked the Faculty Senate to look into three things. And they are the idea of creating some kind of anti-racism center, the idea of some kind of four-credit educational requirement for students, and the idea of a required educational program for faculty. So we set up three different working groups to do this. We have to do a lot of legwork in advance. Nima Kudva, the associate dean, and myself talked to zillions of people and centers and entities on campus to try to understand this issue. These working groups have met pretty intensely during the November-December period. They produced draft reports with the idea being that we want to get feedback on these before we submit the final version. These working groups are reporting to the Senate, right? The Senate will get these recommendations and then act on them, okay? And the idea is for the Senate to pass along, final recommendations to the president and the provost, okay? The Senate has no budget, no authority to implement any of this. We just have to make a powerful case to the president and the provost and the deans, all right, who will look at the recommendations and see what can be done. So you see the timeline there. Right now, we're in this period where we are refining these recommendations. We want to have absolutely impeccable arguments for the various parts of the recommendation. We want to anticipate every possible hesitation that might come when reading about these proposals and so on. So that's where we are right now. And let's talk a little bit about these three different components of the initiative. Let me actually begin by clarifying this. So what we mean by anti-racism. And here's an analogy, okay? Let me pose it this way, something we're all obviously extremely familiar with. So are you anti-pandemic, okay? So the question is, what do you do when you see somebody without a mask, okay? Maybe you don't do anything, and here are three possible reasons. One is you're not wearing the mask yourself. Right? You don't believe in them. Okay. Second, you feel that just wearing your mask is enough. You're doing your part. Okay. But maybe you're wearing a mask and you'd like to say something, but you don't know what to say. Maybe you lack the confidence. Maybe you don't have enough understanding to muster a powerful, convincing, scientific argument. Okay? So are you anti-pandemic? Okay, so let's just step through this for this case. Suppose you see a racial situation that needs addressing. Now, this could be something personal in the street, in a meeting or whatever, or it could be that you see institutional racism and you want to do something about it. So here are some reasons why you may not do anything, okay? First of all, you willingly buy into the situation yourself, okay? You don't think there's anything wrong, or you think, well, that's just okay. Or, privately you think there's something wrong, you shake your head, you know that you would never engage in this behavior and so on. And so, you're doing your part and that's good enough. The third situation is you'd really like to do something. You know there's something wrong. You'd like to say something. You'd like to do something, but you lack the confidence. Or maybe you don't, you just are not articulate enough, or you feel you're not articulate enough to actually muster something significant to say. So you sort of see what's going on here. To be an anti-racist means you have to be proactive. That's a critical component of what we're trying to do here. Okay, so let's step through this is again an update, and I'm happy to when I'm done to go into detail. Our websites have a lot of information. Anyway, let's talk about the student educational requirement, the logic behind it, okay? So we sort of think of there being two different parts, okay? It's sort of a literacy part and a skill part. So the literacy part, and this is kind of new in a certain sense, we need our students to understand the historical basis for structural racism, colonialism, bias, and injustice, okay? There's a historical context to all that. And this is something we've been doing now for years on campus, through intergroup dialogue project and various workshops and sessions that we all attend, that we just become much more skilled. We understand things better and we change our behaviors and so on. So here's sort of a handy example to distinguish between these two components. Take implicit bias. Many of us have been through sessions where we discover all our implicit bias, right? And those are profound. You're sort of shocked at your own behavior, your own prejudice. But that's sort of the end of it. The question then is, why do you have implicit bias? What was it about your upbringing or your culture and your experiences, where did this come from? okay? And the idea is that we have to understand those sorts of questions to really make institutional change, okay? So one way of looking at the literacy part is through the usual lens of liberal education, that part of liberal education is recognizing how little you know and makes you hungry to learn more and to become a lifelong learner. So you can phrase all this as in a way that, you know, we've had this sort of view of liberal education, breadth of education. We see it in our undergraduate requirements, but there's a big gap. Okay, there's a gap, and we have to fill that gap. Okay. So two approaches here I'd like to highlight. One is the one that we're trying to implement and trying to suggest a framework for doing, and the other one is through a menu. Well, let's actually begin with that because that's most easily described. So we're talking about let's talk about courses, and you can have perhaps a menu of courses and require every student, let's talk undergraduate, every student take one such course while they're here, okay? So if you visit Cal's, their undergraduate scene has a diversity requirement. The Arts College just instituted a social difference requirement. These are menu type arrangements, okay? Now, there are lots of positive things you can say about the menu approach. You can sort of maybe live off of existing curriculum. There's flexibility. It gives students choice. And no one likes requirements, but if you have choice within that requirement, it's a whole different ballpark. Students have different interests. And the idea then is that on that menu will be something that really resonates and is just right for you. There are also logistical things concerning the delivery of such a requirement. So the menu approach comes to mind rapidly, but there's certain things wrong with it. Menus are very hard to maintain. What's the criteria for getting on the menu? And so on. So there turns out that there are issues with the menu approach. And we have ideas if we go that route, how to compensate for some of the weaknesses that you typically see in a menu approach. What we're trying to do, however, is something a little bit different, quite a bit different, as a matter of fact. Again, you want to think of the requirement as having two parts, a literacy part and sort of a skill part. And what we'd like to somehow do is integrate the literacy part into the disciplines where you engage with people in your area, faculty in your area. You talk about, say, structural racism within your field, things like that. You'd like to integrate the pink with the green, okay? This will also address a logistical problem, which is to say, if you're talking about something that every student must do, that's a huge staffing issue. And you have to somehow get the requirement into the disciplines where you have the faculty talent and to pull it off. So that's kind of where we are right now. We're trying to figure out how to roll out, deliver, and integrate the two halves in that sort of model. It's not a done deal. The menu, there are menu ideas out there. Anyway, that's sort of where we are with this. Let's talk about the idea of a center, okay? And the working group has a vision for that center, okay? And you can sort of read that. There are two features to it that I think are worth highlighting. One is what you might call current events. Things happen that demand sort of immediate attention. All right? You think about the George, the killing in the summer there, and events like that just the George Floyd killing that just drive local discussions in a really profound way. And the center has to be responsive to that. But then there's a long-term aspect to it. The idea is to affect change, okay? That means affecting policy and so on. And so that has to be sort of a constant ongoing part of the center's operation. It has to be institutionally supported and a real focal point for research and teaching in this sort of area. So the name is actually pretty important, and we have a current name that you can sort of see there, and that is not cast in concrete. As we've refined in the next few weeks what the center does, we might change that name. But the idea then is to create a center. So already on campus, we have lots of work in this area distributed amongst our many, many centers. We have over 200 centers, programs, and institutes on campus. What you see on the slide here are sort of 25 of them, roughly, who have as part of their agenda work that relates to anti-racism. So if we create a center, that center is going to have to connect and relate to what we already have on the ground. So there's a lot of interesting challenges with that. One is, you might think of it as an environmental impact. If we create this new center, how is it going to affect work that we already have? We certainly don't want to get into a competition sort of thing, the idea being that there's a fixed pool of resources and now there's a new center on the block, and that's going to take resources away from my center and so on. We can't have that. So we're figuring out and have a nice set of ideas where there's, you know, cooperation amongst the anti-racism center and these other entities in a way that strengthens their work and so on. There's also, whenever you do these sorts of things, you want to pay attention to what your peers do, not to be copycat, but just simply to get the sort of a general lay of the land so that, So anyway, here's a lineup of, I don't know, 15 or so different centers that exist at other schools that relate to this topic. You can see there are various combinations of issues that these centers handle. And I'd like to just pick up on three words that show up amongst these. So one is truth, right? We want to expose, you know, there's a history out there that's been suppressed or not fully appreciated. We want to get the truth out, all right, about why things have happened and come to pass in our own country. Johns Hopkins has a really interesting project on what they call it hard histories at Hopkins, because they too have a mixed past that has to be understood. And they are going after that with a vengeance, sort of a local history sort of thing. So these are hard topics. These are uncomfortable topics. And it's supposed to be, okay? There'd be something wrong if this was easy. So this is a really hard challenge for us to do this. Certainly, I've been here like 46 years. I've had all kinds of experience with, you know, different projects and initiatives and whatever. I would say this is by far the most complex, the most challenging of them all, okay? But also the most exciting by many standards. Princeton has an interesting, it's a pretty focused center. It's called the Just Data Lab. Okay, so I'm a STEM person, and half the campus is STEM. And you might say, well, you know, there's not a heck of a lot in my area that intersects or will intersect an anti-racism center. But that is just not true. Okay. There's a huge amount, you know, how we use data, statistics, there's a real history there, a disturbing history that's worthy of our attention. So I just highlight that because, again, oftentimes people say, all right, I'm a STEM instructor, what can I do in my class? You know, and there's plenty, it turns out, you can do in your class. Okay, let me go to the next slide here. We spent a little time on what would go on in the center, and a lot of it's all the usual things. This is very much modeled after the Society for the Humanities. So there'd be some kind of annual focal theme, and we have a couple of examples that we've put in the report. The key is when you look at that lineup, you begin to see that this touches all corners of the campus. So then in any given year, you would have a theme, and you would have a program where faculty, researchers from other universities would come and spend time here. we have an idea that we want to have practitioners, people who maybe have worked as activists or whatever, to have some kind of activist in practice program where accomplished individuals who have worked out in communities and so on would spend 2 weeks on campus, much as the A.B. White professors do, teaching students, visiting with students, engaging with students. Maybe you're a Cornell professor and your specialty is environmental justice, then you would try to get maybe some teaching relief and spend one semester in the center during that special year. We want to pay a lot of attention to getting individuals into university positions, and so there would be a pre-doctoral and a postdoctoral component to this. And then all the usual grant-making programs. So there's a little bit in the report about what the center does. Okay? And this is a really important aspect that we want to stress, which is activism, that the center should be an activist center. And this sort of has two implications, right? And one has to be very open-minded about what we mean by activism. So one is the idea that, you know, students would sort of like engage Cornell. You get out beyond the classroom. You learn things in class. You get out and you apply them. You learn from that. You come to a new level of self-awareness and so on. And then you have sort of research-driven components the idea is to create and convince people to change policy, to create new policy, to do research that justifies those sorts of changes. So that's activism as we are construing it. So we spent some time, there's actually a half page on this, because it's very important. And people often think of activism in a negative way, all right? And we want to now make sure this is well understood in our approach. Let me wrap up here with a little bit of discussion on the faculty education piece. And here's sort of the logic, okay? So, structural racism and systemic bias stand between what Cornell is and what it should be. You need a faculty that actively works to dismantle racial and cultural barriers. It's absolutely essential. And you have to be educated and understand the history of how we got here to do that. So the faculty as well have learning to do, and one has to factor that into the proposal. Just a couple of features of this. We already have a lot of DEI programming on campus. We have a whole office, the Office of Faculty Development and Diversity, that has done a tremendous amount of good work. The whole historical side to things needs to be made accessible to faculty. So whatever we produce for students, that is to be shared with the faculty in some effective fashion. At various points in a faculty person's life, there's waypoints where you're evaluated. There are places where times when units are evaluated for how they're doing. And there are proposals in there to enhance accountability on both scores there. So that sort of rounds out the faculty piece, which again is to really heighten the engagement of faculty in these efforts. Already, there's a lot of stuff out there. So this is a little bit different than the other two components of the initiative. We have a lot on the ground already. The question is to make it, so to speak, more required and to enhance the quality and the historical component of what we have. Okay, Whirlwind Tour. Again, we have these three different components. A timeline, we're getting near the end. We sort of have another maybe 2 or 3 weeks where we're refining these proposals, and this is a great place for you to register your thoughts about it. You click on any of those links, you go to a place where you can post your anonymously any kind of comment on our website. And that's sort of it, and I'm open for questions on any of this. Any of these three things that you'd like to talk about. Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And so if anyone has any questions or comments, please raise your hand. I see Ariel had her hand up first, so you can go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for your work on this. I'm sure it's a colossal undertaking. I guess I was wondering about the proposed policy of having faculty be required to do some of this anti-racism training within their fields. I can see some problems with that because I know within my own field there are several older faculty members who are notorious for doing overtly racist things or saying overtly racist things. And so I know, you wouldn't want to have those folks who, you know, wouldn't buy into the mission of this anti-racism doing those sorts of trainings. But then if you exclude those sorts of people, like, you know, who from my experience are older faculty members who have more time on their hands, you really are putting the pressure on younger faculty members, and especially like younger faculty members of color who really should be using their time on research and trying to, you know, get tenure and be retained at the university. And so you don't want to include all professors, but then the set of professors who would do the best job at this is the set that's already the most burdened and also like needs to use their time on other things. So I was wondering why, as part of this initiative, you weren't thinking of trying to add additional faculty lines that like would have this center and like running anti-racism trainings as part of their responsibilities. Like, why wouldn't it make sense to try and hire more people doing anti-racist scholarship?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the faculty line resource question again, just briefly on that, the Senate, we can only put together powerful arguments and then hopefully the deans and the provost will respond with the appropriate resources. In terms of the training, so there might be a little bit of a confusion here about the education piece, you know, who is going to get up there and talk about the structural racism that may exist within your field and so on. And you are right that not all faculty will be able to do that. But we're talking about sort of basic training just so that you can teach your course as it is without, creating issues. So the dynamics that we have to deal with here are the following. So you have the so-called preaching to the choir component, and they don't need anything. Then you have the people who are never going to come in, you know, the entrenched faculty member who's just set in their way, sees no point to all this, and just refuses to even acknowledge that there's something there that perhaps is worth learning. There are, we want to give chairs tools to respond to this, that if you want to, for example, if you want to be a hire students in a lab, you have to take certain training just to do that. So we've identified a number of certain tasks that come up in the life of a professor and that you won't be able to do those unless you are suitably trained. Another dynamic that we're very conscious of is this, that it's possible for people to become more entrenched in their views if they're forced to do something. So the way you respond to that is these trainings have to be extremely interesting. People should want to go to them. And that's why the historical part has tremendous potential, because if done in the right way, these become, genuinely interesting sessions to sit in on. So anyway, of all the three initiatives, this is the one in our preliminary reading in the Senate where you get the most criticism. And I don't want to exaggerate it at all. I think the vast majority of faculty understand the need to ratchet up our work in this area. But it's the area where we've seen the most pushback. So freedom of speech, you can't tell me what to do and so on. But I'm sort of confident that the mood in the Senate is totally different since the events of early summer. And people it's an occasion to really institute some change here in how we approach these things. Okay. Yep.
Yeah, I guess just a point of clarification. I was more talking about I think you had mentioned like having faculty talking to students within their own field about anti-racism and leading discussions, and that's where I was worried about the time demands on younger faculty members. And then I guess in terms of having a lot of momentum behind this anti-racism at the moment, like I feel like now would be the time to make big demands of the administration, like, you know, additional faculty lines or something to make this happen. Of course, you understand the situation a lot better than I do, so I will stop talking. But yeah,
there's no question. This is we're in a moment right now, and the administration understands that this particular initiative. So like if you look back in time, we did this early since the 2000. Like every 4 or 5 years, there's something like this that goes on. Okay. What sets this particular initiative apart is that we were asked by the president to come up with something. Usually it's something that the faculty gets together and proposes something to the administration. This one is different. We were actually asked to come up with recommendations. So there's a lot of hope here that something can come from this. And as we all understand, this is on people's minds much more than ever before, and there's, I think, a real chance to do something. I think, David, you call off the hands, right, or call up?
Okay, yeah, so we have two more hands up, and then I think we have to move on. So next is Erin Maloney.
Hi, I kind of have a clarification that's kind of tangential to Ariel's question, and then an actual question based on that clarification.
Sure.
So for the clarification point, are you having already existing faculty and staff become the staff of the center, or are you hiring new people?
Right. Okay, good point. So again, the funding of the center, whether it has a physical place or not, is something that we have to hear from the president and the provost. Most centers on campus, depends on their size, quote, staffed by faculty. So, for example, I might be half-time in physics and half-time in the synchrotron, okay? And so that will no doubt be part of the scene, okay? You'll have a director who will be a faculty member from some department. In terms of extra hiring, implicit in all this is that there, in this general area, we'll have to increase the number of faculty who do this sort of work. There'll also be staff, right, managing directors and so on. Those will be part of the scene, but our job in the Senate is to define what the center does and maybe sketch out, and we've done that, about the advisory committee, what did that look like, how is the director chosen? We've done things like that. From that, when it comes time for the administration to fund it, then is when you get into the real guts of increased number of lines and budget and so on.
But okay,
most of the centers are faculty work in centers to varying degrees. You could be half time, quarter time, or whatever, that sort of thing.
Okay, so my actual question is for those new faculty lines, will you be increasing the diversity within applications and reviewing of new hires?
Yeah. So faculty are hired into departments, okay? And the role of the center in that enterprise would be certainly in terms of offering suggestions or nominating candidates. But the real role of the center in terms of hiring in the direction that you're alluding to is this: that if the center is an exciting, vibrant place for research, this will attract faculty into the departments. And that's how I would sort of address your question there.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, last question before we have to move on, Liz.
Hey, Charlie, thanks for coming today. I was just wondering if you could elaborate more for the other people in the group about the composition of these committees, how people were selected to be on the committees, and why President Pollack chartered you all to even talk about the anti-racism initiative in the first place.
Sure. So let me work the second question first. So education research is the province of the faculty, right? And the Senate is a place where ideas are advanced and address those two very, teaching and research. So it's the proper place for figuring that out. Most easily it's seen in terms of like the educational requirement for students. Okay, so that's a faculty issue. It's a complicated one because we got 7 undergraduate colleges that control their own curriculum and so on. But the education is the province of the faculty, so it's the natural place to go. As opposed to the alternative would be for the provost to set up some sort of ad hoc committee to look into things. This is the Senate. This is the faculty Senate where we can formulate ideas, package them up in resolutions, and vote. Okay, that sort of thing. Then in terms of the committee makeup, so we use Do Better Cornell to get students. When we talk to faculty in the early part, the late part of the summer in the various centers to suggest students, we contacted people that way and so on. So the committees vary a little bit in terms of size, but they're about roughly 15 faculty, and I know the center one is the larger one. We probably have 6 or 7 students on that committee. So it was pretty much done that way. So I don't have the slides of the committee makeup, but you can find those online. It's been a really great dialogue, I would sort of say. Because faculty, especially faculty like me, right, don't see things that students see. And so it's been extremely informative during this whole process. I was sort of surprised that the more students were interested in the center than in sort of the educational requirement. But after talking with students and faculty for 2 or 3 months now, I understand why.
Can you say a little bit more on why, Charlie? I feel like I don't want to like take up space, but I just I don't know. I feel like the reason that, because I personally sit on the Working Group C committee, and I think the reason that a lot of people students are interested in this committee specifically is because since this whole initiative was brought up because of Do Better Cornell's demands this summer, a lot of Black students want a space for Black students to be able to operate and be supported and uplifted on campus. I just wanted to make sure that was said.
Yeah. Physical space is really important at all, certainly on the at many different levels. First of all, it fosters collaboration and all the usual things. And also, it's a real physical statement. You know, there's a building, that's the center. And that is a powerful thing to say. So, that's right. So one of the things that we learned over these last few months is this, the relative importance of that. It's always been important, but it was brought into very sharp focus by the students. Okay, I guess that's it. So thank you very much. I'd really love to get the chat. If you have a chat transcript, you can send me afterwards so I can answer questions. I'm not reading the chat right now, but I can answer questions that have emerged there.
Okay, so if anyone has any more questions, I think for the sake of time, maybe if they could just email them to you. But I think we have several other things to have to deal with on our agenda. So if it's all right, I'd like to move on for now. But thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
No. Okay, so our next item on the agenda is elections, vacancies, and appointments. So these are all vacancies that are normally elected positions, but since they became vacant in the middle of this term, the executive committee has the authority to appoint someone to lead these committees or these positions. But I'd like to put this on the agenda for the sake of the opportunity for someone to introduce themselves. If they want to ask questions about any of these appointments, we can do that. So the first is the finance chair. So for those of you who are new, this is a very important committee that commission that's doing work that making sure that your organizations are budgets are being approved and handling all the financial aspects of the GPSA. And Ariel Johnson has been the interim chair since the beginning of this semester because we haven't been able to find someone willing to take over the chair. And we've been in discussions with administrators and with the Dean Bohr very recently about changes, short-term and long-term changes we can make to try to make this chair a little bit more incentivize, make it a little bit easier for someone to take on this position. So I think for now, would Ariel like to say a few words about where we stand in that right now?
Sure. So as of this afternoon, we have a surprise nominee for the position. Thank you so much, Caroline, for stepping in to taking on this job. As everyone in this assembly has heard, this is absolutely crucial for the functioning of all graduate and professional student organization funding. And so this is a highly administrative position with a lot of responsibility. And from talking to Caroline, I am convinced that she can handle it. So I am delighted to go ahead and confirm Caroline, if we can put that on the agenda.
Okay, so how about we do it this way? If Caroline could say a few words, then if there are no objections from anyone in the assembly, then we will, the executive committee will appoint Caroline to the chair. But first, Caroline, would you like to introduce yourself briefly?
Hi, I'm Caroline. I'm a third-year PhD candidate in the microbiology department. And I am currently the president of our student organization, but my term is going to be ending in a couple months here. So I'm interested in taking on another administrative role. So as soon as I saw the opening, I jumped on it. And that's when I started talking to Ariel.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any objections from anyone in the assembly with Caroline taking over the chair of the Finance Commission? Or is there anyone else who is interested in this appointment that would like to be considered? Please raise your hand. Okay, seeing none, Caroline, welcome to GPSA and the Finance Commission. Thank you very much. And we'll be in touch soon about getting you on board, and we'll try to help as best we can.
Great, thank you.
Okay, thank you. So our next position is the Student Advocacy Chair. The Student Advocacy Committee is working on issues of finances, stipend levels, mental and physical health, childcare, and general well-being. So, and this is currently an empty committee. There's no one working on any of these topics. So we've really and it's been vacant for this entire term so far. Is there anyone who has any questions about the position or would like to be considered to be appointed to it? Please raise your hand. David Kent, you recognize.
Hi. Yeah, I'd be happy to nominate myself for the position. I'm a third year PhD student in statistics, and I've been a member of the Cornell community for a while. Before that, I was an employee in the milk quality improvement program and food safety lab and food science for a number of years. And I'd be happy to take on the role.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be considered for this appointment? Please raise your hand. Okay, seeing none, are there any objections to us appointing David Kent to student advocacy? Okay, seeing none, congratulations and welcome to the committee. Thank you. All right, our next vacancy is the Diversity and International Students Committee Chair. Same situation as last time. Is there anyone who would like to be considered for the chair of this committee? Okay, seeing none, then this will remain vacant until our next meeting, in which case we'll bring it up again. We have heard from, I think, one person who might be interested, but so if you happen to, you know, become interested later, please just email us. You don't have to wait until the next meeting to express your interest. Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I have been chatting with one person who is interested, and they just need a little more time to decide and have a little more chat, but hopefully we'll have someone interested by next meeting.
Okay, thank you. So our next position is a voting member for Masters at Large. So any master's student is eligible to be considered for this voting member position. Is there anyone who is a master's student here today who is not already a voting member who would like to be considered for this appointment? Okay, seeing none, then this will remain vacant as well until our next meeting. So that exhausts all the items under elections, vacancies, and appointments. We will now move on to the next item of business, which is unfinished business. Resolution 9, extending voting membership to standing committee chairpersons. Since I am the sponsor of this resolution, I hereby relinquish the chair to Nick Danev until we have disposed of this resolution.
Hi. All right. So seeing that we've had more voting members join, I see that we do have 19 present at least. We need 19 to pass this resolution. So we could, in theory, have a vote on it if there is a motion for that. But with that, I'm going to open up the floor to any discussion on Resolution 9. David has already presented it. But yeah, if anyone wants to say anything or motion for anything, go ahead.
Point of order, I don't remember what Resolution 9 is. Could you do a two-sentence summary of which one it was?
Yes, David, you're recognized.
Yeah, so this is the resolution that extends voting membership to all the committee chairpersons. So just pretty straightforward, this is a charter amendment, which means that it requires a two-thirds majority of the entire membership for it to be approved. And that's why this was postponed several meetings, because we didn't have two-thirds of all our members present until now. By my understanding, we now have 25 seated voting members. So I think a two-thirds majority would need 17, if I'm not mistaken. Right?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I'm not good with math. I had to do that real quick. So we could vote on it today. Otherwise, it would have to basically fall off our agenda and I have to bring it back again. But yeah, just to answer your question, that's what that is. Yeah.
Okay. So we actually have 21 voting members present right now.
Right.
More than we've ever had. So are there any motions or David?
I would actually make an amendment real quick to correct something that I think, and I will state it out loud and post it in the chat. So I would like to insert the following after line 41, be it further resolved. Hold on, I'm going to put it in the chat first. Be it further resolved that the following section 404D be inserted after line 206, voting members shall be limited to one vote, even if that member holds multiple ex officio voting member positions. This just deals with the situation that came up, I think, when I first introduced this, that a person could be a chair of multiple committees, and that does not mean that you can have multiple votes. I think it seems pretty straightforward, but it has to be clarified here. So I hope that we can just approve this amendment real quick and then go on to further discussion.
So seeing that there's an amendment on the floor, I'm going to ask if anyone wants to go into open debate on the amendment. And if no one wants to go into open debate, then we'll move on to a vote specifically for the amendment, not the resolution. This will require a majority vote, not a two-thirds vote. So would anyone like to take part in debate, or is there any motions on the floor? David, is your hand raised? There is
no, I'll lower it. Okay. Yeah, sorry.
Does anyone want a motion? Okay, there we go.
Sorry, if there's no further discussion, I move the previous question to vote on the amendment.
All right, we have a motion to vote. All of the voting members, please vote by raising your hand if you are in favor. If you're abstaining or against, do not raise your hand yet. So just raise your hand if you're a voting member and if you are in favor of this amendment. All right, seeing 19 in favor, this amendment passes. If you are against, could you please just write no in the chat? Okay, no against, which leaves us with two abstentions. So this passes, this amendment passes 19-0-2. Now that we have this amendment, the original resolution is back on the floor. Are there any motions pertaining to this?
And if everyone could lower your hand, if so. Yeah, okay. Motion.
David.
I move the previous question on the resolution.
Okay, there is a motion to vote on Resolution 9 as amended today. With that, all voting members in favor, please raise your hand. All right, so I see 20 votes in favor. If anyone is against, please write no in the chat. Okay, seeing no one is against, this resolution passes, and we have amended the charter with a vote of 20-0-1. And with that, I am relinquishing the chair and passing it back to David.
Okay, thank you very much, Nick. And please be aware if that this resolution does not go into effect until President Pollack approves it, since it's a charter amendment. So if you're a committee chairperson and you're not a voting member, please hold off on voting until I give confirmation that it's been approved. So our next item of business is new business, the first of which is Resolution 12, addressing the ITAP and University Policy 1.3. We have four sponsors. Would one of them like to step forward to introduce this resolution? Nick.
Thank you. So this is a resolution that we've talked about for a while. I'm just going to send the link over so everyone can see it. And then I'm going to share my screen as I present it. Okay. Can everyone see this? Cool. So the ITAP and University Policy 1.3 both pertain to what we had been talking about that was identified as a major problem for in the GPCI previously for international students specifically. It's this program where it's seemingly randomly or just based by like how American your name sounds, you get selected to have to take this assessment, the ILA, for essentially how well you can speak English. It doesn't seem to have a very objective way of assessing students and their performance. And if you don't pass it, you can't be a TA. And that messes with a lot of people's funding because a lot of us have to be TAs in order to get funding or in order to graduate. With that, I guess I'm just briefly going to talk about what we have in here. Also, this is sponsored by me, Kavya, Liz, and Christine. And basically, the whereas clauses kind of just talk about what the issues are, the vague requirements set forth by University Policy 1.3, which outlines the necessity for the ITAP's existence, the fact that you can't be exempt if you have a previous degree in English, the fact that, there's a TA ban that gets placed on the student, which actually shouldn't be done externally. The DGS should be the person that has this power. They're essentially taking away power from the DGSs. The ITAP also has no formal advisory committee or oversight. We don't know how much money they're getting. We asked, they never told us. Also, the GPCI recognized it as an issue. 90.5% of surveyed graduate and professional students expressed dissatisfaction. Over 84% of students targeted by the ITAP are from one geographic region, and that's predominantly East Asia. Student funding is contingent on it. The class requires 200 hours of active work, and sometimes people have to take it up to four or five times before they graduate from the class and they're allowed to TA. that's about 1,000 hours of work that they were never told about when they applied to Cornell or when they committed to coming to Cornell. You can't appeal an ITAP decision. You get an epithet, I guess, which says that you're an international teaching assistant, which I personally find derogatory, and it introduces bias and xenophobia. Like, I think as an international teaching assistant, I am just as good as a regular teaching assistant. I also think the current political climate, and mind you, this resolution was drafted under Donald Trump's time, presents many problems for international students, but also just because we have a new president, that doesn't necessarily mean that everything's changed. And there's no clear guidelines for policy 1.3. No peer institutions have anything like this, and so many more issues. So what we're proposing is that the ITAP be changed. It's currently being reviewed, but we want students to be involved in it. We want directors of graduate studies or their appointees to be involved in it and to have equal power as the university administrators in revising it. We want the ITAP to be disbanded, and we want them to not subject the incoming PhD students to this because they were never informed of it. There has to be a better ITAP review process. And also, we want to condemn the racist and xenophobic behavior of Cornell affiliates, which reports have been filed for. I don't think this is kind of the space for me to go specifically into naming people, but there have been reports related to the ITAP, specifically about racism and xenophobia, and the GPSA, I think, should strongly and unambiguously condemn that kind of behavior. So with that, that's kind of the brief spiel on the ITAP. Now, a little bit unconventional here, I'm not going to ask that the Assembly vote on this today. I'd like to ask that the Assembly send it back to the sponsoring committee, to the approving committee, which is the Executive Committee. And the reason that I'm asking for you to do this is because I'd like to also introduce a motion where you would task the sponsors of this resolution, myself and the other people supporting it, to meet with the provost, who is willing to work with us on this. And then once we reach an agreement with him and his office, I think we can come out with a more powerful resolution that would come from us and also from his office, and it would be on both of our behalf. So instead of kind of making this resolution be a list of demands, it would be a resolution acknowledging the work that we've done together with the provost. But yeah, with that, I'd love to field any questions, and I'm sure that Kavya and Liz and Christine might want to have something to say.
Okay, thank you very much, Nick. First, is there a second to considering this resolution?
Second.
All right, it's been seconded, so the question is now before the Assembly. Is there any discussion? Please raise your hand.
Point of clarification, is the vote to send it to the Executive Committee, as Nick outlined?
Yeah, so right now we're just discussing the resolution itself, but then after discussion's over, we'll make a motion to refer it to the Executive Committee under these conditions, basically. Of course, the Assembly can override that and say no, but that'll be the motion we'll consider later. So does that answer your question? Okay. Mila Kantar?
Yeah, I was just considering thinking about what's the specifically demand, if it's to get rid of this requirement or if it's to modify the consequences of not passing, for example. Like, it's not quite clear what you're asking.
Nick, would you like to answer that?
Yeah, so the request here is that it is completely overhauled. So the ITAP, as you know it, wouldn't exist anymore. Obviously, we're not just going to remove all requirements whatsoever, but it's going to be a much different approach. And while I don't have the specifics outlined right now, it's not going to be a situation where you come in and you don't know that you're going to be tested, and then you have to take this test, and then you end up in this mandatory class. It's going to be much more transparent. It's going to be a voluntary process and not a mandatory process, where anyone that wants to TA is able to participate in these classes. And if you don't meet these minimum requirements, then you know, you're informed in advance of them, and it kind of just streamlines the process, and it removes the subjectiveness of who passes and who doesn't pass right now. So instead of just targeting anyone that kind of might seem international for some reasons, this would actually be a structured way of doing it, and doing it voluntarily rather than forcing people to do it.
I just want to add, for those who aren't international students, you may not be aware of this, but international students already have requirements, either TOEFL or the IELTS, that they have to pass before they can even apply for admission. So graduate school does have a minimum level already that you have to pass before you can apply for admission to any Cornell program. So the ITAP is on top of that. After passing that minimum requirement, they have a further higher requirement to teach, which is why you have to take this test, and why you have to go through this class. And I have asked before, what's part of the GPCI, why they have a higher or a different requirement from the graduate school itself, and no, receive a reply.
Sorry, if I could just also
go ahead
there.
Yeah.
I totally agree with what Tavia said. That was very important. I completely forgot to mention that. And I just also want to add that, so essentially, the idea is we want to make something similar to what our peer institutions have, and we've been discussing, and Dean Bohr has been helping us with this as well, and we've been discussing with other peer institutions, and there's definitely a lot of ideas floating around. But at the very least, we want to make sure that you're never blindsided. You come to Cornell as an international student, and you have no idea, like, that this is about to happen to you.
Okay, thank you. Is there any further discussion? Okay, Nick.
I'd like the motion for this resolution to be sent back to the executive committee, and also that the sponsors or their designees are tasked with meeting with the provost to discuss and work further on amending this resolution and coming to an agreement.
Okay, so there's been a motion to refer this to the executive committee with the task that Nick just described. Is there a second to this motion?
Second.
All right, it's been seconded. Is there any discussion? All right, seeing none, then please raise your hand if you're in favor. Voting members. Okay, I see 17 in favor. All those against, if you are, could please write no in the chat. Okay, with 17 in favor and none against, the motion passes, and this resolution is now referred to the executive committee. Thank you very much. Is there any additional new business that anyone would like to bring before the assembly today? If so, please raise your hand. New business as in any resolutions or motions that could be a resolution that haven't been announced prior. All right, seeing none, then we'll now move on to the next order of business, which is division breakout. I think we have just enough time to do division breakout, so if we could please assign people to their breakout rooms. We'll also take attendance of field representatives now, too. Okay, it seems like most people are back now, so let's proceed with the next item on the agenda, which is committee updates. First, let's hear from the executive committee. Nick, do you have anything to share?
No updates from the executive committee right now.
Okay, communications, Kavya?
Yeah, so I'm working on getting more stuff on the website, so hopefully some of you saw the social media things, positions open and came here because of that, but we'll try for any of the remaining open positions to advertise a little more, as well as for next year. And not necessarily communications, but I just want to add the Public Safety Advisory Committee is also looking for people. I'm on it temporarily, but if anyone is interested, please let me know, because we would love to have more students on there.
Okay, thank you. Operations, Mardik?
I mean, we stopped the FC chair today, so that's great.
but that's pretty much it. We have been mostly into staff committees so far, so please come forward if you want to be in any committees.
Yeah, that was great. Okay, finance, we look forward to hearing from you next time. Appropriations, Akarsha, do you have anything to share? Not sure if she's here right now. Okay, Diz, we'll hear from you next time. Faculty teaching, Cody?
So no real updates for the Faculty Awards Committee. We just got the information about staffing and people who want to get involved. So anyone who is interested and signed up should be hearing back from me pretty soon.
Okay, thank you. Programming, Casey?
I'll deliver Casey's update. So the programming board has a few updates. They're currently working with Cornell Chimes to organize a Build Your Own Wind Chimes event. They will be sending out information over the listserv in the next few days for representatives to pass along to their constituents. And then also there's a clarifying point. So a lot of the committee chairs have reached out to people that have expressed interest in their committees, but a lot of people haven't responded. And this is just a reminder, if you are a voting member, you must be on a committee, and everyone else is very strongly encouraged to also be on a committee.
Right, thank you. And Student Advocacy will hear from that committee next time. So that concludes that section, and we'll now move on to...
Sorry, can I just give a quick this thing
sure.
on DISC?
So go ahead, Kavya.
One of the DISC events that has been still going on is the Building Allyship Series. And the one that's going to happen Feb 24th, 12 to 1:30 p.m. is coming out for allyship with the LGBTQ community. So I'm just going to put the link for the as well as the registration in the chat.
Okay, thank you. We'll now move on in the remaining time to open forum. This is where anyone in the community can present to the GPSA on any topic or any statement. Does anyone want to speak now? Someone has their hand up. Mardik, would you like to speak?
Yeah, hi. Thanks, David, for giving me the chance to talk. Mm-hmm. So we talked about this mostly in our breakout room, which is life sciences, about how the pandemic has impacted our research. And since it's been going on for almost a year now, and we weren't able to go to lab or work for almost like one third of it. And also a lot of like field work has been impacted because of domestic and international travel. So I was curious as to how everyone's work has been affected, and trying to gauge the interest in the room about how they feel about what can be done from the university to help navigate those problems going forward, and also like make amends for what has been lost. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's a great point, Mark. Would anyone like to build on that? Maggie.
Hi, David. Thanks, Mardik, for making such a necessary and really pressing point. I was thinking about this actually as I was submitting a question for the upcoming graduate town hall for tomorrow evening. And I'm sort of the opinion, and have been for some time, along with the significant majority of my own department in English, that the university needs to be working much harder sort of in tandem with the graduate school and with graduate students, not only to sort of assess the needs of our sort of unique population, but also to push really, really aggressively, quite frankly, for at least a full year extension time to degree in terms of funding, but also in terms of the degree timeline. I think it's honestly ridiculous that we are sort of expected to carry on as per usual and make sort of that time to degree a usual sort of ex- extent of our professional lives, despite the fact that so many of us are missing huge swaths of research time, going to archives, missing library materials, things of that nature as well, that are severely impacting our ability to do our work, not at all to mention, right, the sort of insignificant impact on mental health and sort of overall levels of productivity that I have been seeing in myself, but also in a lot of other graduate students that I have been associating with. So I just sort of want to firmly come out as firmly as I can and say that there needs to be an assessment of extending time to degree for all graduate students affected by the pandemic in their time to degree timeline.
Thanks so much, Maggie.
Can I make
for that
a privilege motion?
Go ahead, Nick.
Motion to extend the meeting time because we should have adjourned by now, but I know people still have things to talk about. So could we extend it by, say, 10 minutes until 7:10 p.m.?
Okay. Is there a second to the motion to extend by 10 minutes?
Second.
All right. Are there any objections to extending the meeting? All right. Seeing none, the meeting's extended by 10 minutes. Is there any further discussion? Kavya.
Sorry, just following up on Maggie said, I didn't actually realize that there was a town hall tomorrow for graduate students, which given what we do is kind of bad. So I just kind of want to stress that there is a town hall tomorrow for graduate students that Catherine Bohr is going to be at and the Vice Provost of Graduate Education. So I'm putting the link in here for anybody else who didn't catch it, but it is in the graduate student announcements.
Right, thank you. Any more discussion? So I think since we've extended by 10 minutes, I also have a kind of a question for you all, and I want to get the opinion of graduate and professional students on this. There's going to be a resolution put forward in the University Assembly on the question of renaming Goldwyn Smith Hall, because for many different reasons, the figure Goldwyn Smith was someone who was originally important to the university, but has held very reprehensible views by the standards of the time in which he lived, as well as today's standards, anti-Semitic views, anti-feminist views, imperialist views. And since then, the university has stripped him of his honorary titles, but they have rejected the proposal of renaming Goldwyn Smith Hall. So there's been an effort again to try to rename Goldwyn Smith Hall. So I'm curious to hear more from graduate and professional students, especially those of you in the humanities who use Goldwyn Smith Hall. Are you in favor of such a move? If not, why? What are your opinions? And this is something where I have to cast a vote representing graduate and professional students. I want to make sure that I kind of get people's opinions on it. And if you don't want to like speak up now, you're welcome to email me too, or just let me know other ways. So. Maggie, do you want to speak on this or?
Yeah, sorry, not to monopolize the rest That's of our fine. Time, but just throwing my hat in the ring and saying I 1,000,000% support renaming that hall. I think it's actively very hostile for a lot of the students who have office space in that building and who have to sort of walk into that building and spend a significant amount of time teaching and learning and writing in that building. It's it can be an incredibly sort of frustrating thing to be forced to deal with. So if we could not force people to do that, that I don't know, sounds like a win-win for me.
Okay, great. Tim?
Thank you. Yeah, I don't work over there myself, but it seems deeply bizarre to me to recognize that he was misogynistic and anti-Semitic enough that his name shouldn't be on honorary, chairs, but leave his name on a building. What's the upside of saying, oh yeah, this guy's a horrible anti-Semite, but we're going to keep the building name? I don't see the positive in that other than oh God, it's maybe $100 to redo some signs. I mean, Yeah, that just seems deeply weird to me. If he's bad and everyone is agreeing that, and it seems that they are, then rename the building.
All right, thanks so much, Tim. Does anyone else want to contribute on this topic? Or we could go back to another, to the topic of time to degree extensions, which Maggie brought up.
Yeah, so, hi, David.
Go ahead, yeah.
So I was thinking what the best way to gauge what the interest for time to degree extension would be. Should we do surveys again administered by like the broader part of the grad school or individual colleges or department? And like, how do we gauge the interest about what the graduate population wants, if they at all want a degree extension time or not?
Mm-hmm.
Something I was thinking of, just like folks who are present here and who have like PhD students or like more than like 2 years or even master's students, if you can like talk to folks in your department and see just by word of mouth what they want, and maybe we can probably formalize from there on once we have those conversations, that would be great.
Yeah, it would be helpful for us too as we talk with the university about this question. I think it's also helpful if we could find a way to, I mean, not that we have to prove that we've been struggling or anything, but if there's a way for us to like quantify the research costs over this past year in terms of, not just in terms of our financial costs, but also in terms of how much we are behind where we would be if this pandemic were not to have taken place, that would also be helpful. Ariel, do you have your hand up?
Well, yeah, I mean, we did that survey during the start of the pandemic, which does actually quantify the research losses,
right,
about 2,500 students. So, I mean, I guess it wouldn't quantify what's happened since then, which is considerable, but we do already have statistics.
Right, okay, right. I do remember that, yeah. Tim?
And to follow up on Ariel's point, what that survey showed was that even only 2 or 3 months in, people were already heavily struggling. We had, you know, not just talking about research productivity, but we had increased rates of housing insecurity, increased rates of food insecurity. None of that's gotten better. None of that has improved in the last 10 months. Sorry, go ahead.
Right. Mardik?
I just want to bring it up that, again, like that last survey was student administered, and also a lot of effort went in on the students' part to gauge what other students and they want. I would really hope that moving forward, these surveys are not mostly student-driven, but also a huge input of this comes from the grad school overall, so that it's hopefully a collective effort and not mostly student-driven. That would be great.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. All right, is there any further discussion?
Just the statistic was something like more than half of students surveyed said that their time to degree would be delayed by a semester or more.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
It's really considerable.
Yeah. Maggie?
Sorry again. But I just also something that didn't come up when I was initially sort of trying to think through what I was talking about. I mean, we all know that like the job market was precarious right before before the pandemic. But especially in the humanities that I've seen, the job market has just absolutely imploded. There are no jobs. And we all say that, like, you know, all the time, like, there are no jobs, but there are no jobs. And I don't, I mean, I personally, like, right, like, I'm not a placement expert. I'm not, like, that's not necessarily I'm something super knowledgeable in, but I, from what I am seeing from other precariously employed academics and from recent Cornell PhDs in my department, I don't really see my field recovering for many years. So that's another, I think, sort of really crucial thing to keep in mind when thinking about time to degree extensions. It's not just extending our degree. It is extending our health insurance, and it's extending our ability to
live, to put down roots in a place, right, for longer than, you know, 1-2 year visiting positions. And that's really important. So just wanted to reemphasize that.
Yeah, and I just want to also just to say I'm in German studies, so it's the same situation too. One of the things that we did last semester in my department was, you know, make sure that your grad students are meeting together to discuss the particular challenges that affect your discipline and your field, and figure out what you like sort of demands or resolutions you can bring to your faculty members. But I think that a lot of the solutions ultimately are common to all of us, right? And then they ultimately have to come from the university. So yeah, I just want to boost what you just said there. Yeah. All right. Is there any further discussion? All right. Seeing none, I think we can conclude here. And thank you all for your input, especially on the question of the Goldman-Smith Hall. I'm on board with all of you, and I just wanted to make sure that I got your feedback and take this opportunity to do that. And we'll continue this discussion next time as well. But if there's no further motions or items of business to bring before us, then this meeting is now adjourned. So thank you very much.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.